Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jason Borgern. We'll be answering your most important questions on skinny water trout. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jason Borger about skinny water trout. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts, and to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Jason, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Jason's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of The Angler as Predator, which was written by Jason's father, Gary Borger, and illustrated by Jason. This book is part of a 20-book series that explores a huge range of fly fishing topics. And Jason will enlighten us a little bit about how that project is going here a little later. Now, here's how you can win this book. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win Jason and Gary's book, The Angler as Predator. Tonight our guest is Jason Borger. Jason is a professional fly fishing educator. He published his first fly fishing article at age 13 and began working on fly fishing videos when he was 16. He later worked on the silver screen adaptation of A River Runs Through It, serving as one of the film's fly casting doubles. He is the author of the book, Jason Borger's Nature of Fly Casting, and serves as the education director for the Fly Casting Institute. Jason has contributed articles to magazines such as the Fly Fish America, Fly Fisherman, and Fly Rod and Reel, as well as numerous international publications. In addition to writing, Jason is also an illustrator and a painter of fly fishing subjects. Well, Jason, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks very much, Roger. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's been a while, so good to have you back and talking about fly fishing again, which is always fun for both of us. So
I think you've had my father on a few times over the last several months.
He's been
on talking about long flies or film flies or something. I can't remember exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, we've been doing a show with him every time one of the books comes out, and so you guys have been putting those out quite readily lately, and a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. In fact, some of them turned out to be a little bit more work than we had originally expected. We're hoping to get caught up with our general breakdown of per year book production, but so far it's proven to be a bit of a challenge with a lot of things going on personally and professionally and otherwise. But we are getting done and actually working on a new one called Fly Gear, right now. It's been written, and we're just doing some edits and then dropping in photos and illustrations and so forth. So hopefully that will be ready by year's end. That's our goal right now.
Well, good, good. We'll be looking forward to that. They're great books, and everybody needs to add them to the library, I think. So, and by the way, if you want any of those books, and we are giving one away tonight, as we said, but GaryBorger.com, you can find the books there and see the schedule of upcoming books as well. So, great,
yeah,
great.
Definitely.
Good. Well, you know, I went out to a lot of our guests and asked them, you know, hey, what would you like to talk about? And Jason suggested skinny water trout, and well, that sounds like an interesting topic because it's certainly one of the more challenging situations I think we can get ourselves into. But so let's talk about that, Jason, and let's just start talking about skinny water. You know, in your mind, what is skinny water? What are the characteristics of it? What are we looking at?
I think I would characterize skinny water, and you know, I kind of do the trout version of this because oftentimes when we think about skinny water, we think about fishing saltwater flats, for instance, and bonefish,
right,
or whatever your target species may be. And there are, you know, miles and miles of very skinny, very clear water. So I think if we branch off from the saltwater aspect of it and look at the trout and say, okay, well, what are some of the skinny water characteristics that would apply to trout fishing? I'd say, first of all, you obviously have to have a very thin layer of water. That's really defines the skinny aspect of it. And I would also say that it's typically very clear water, oftentimes a slower current speed. Now, I've fished some very skinny waters that were relatively fast in flow, and fish were parked in behind rocks and that kind of thing. But I think for what we're going to talk about tonight, that's probably less of a focus than the waters that are thin and very clear and slower. And that also includes still waters. A lot of times we think about still waters as being deeper, and you know, talking lakes and ponds and whatever, impoundments, that type of thing. But the edges, the fringes of those types of places can be very, very skinny indeed. And the fish found there can be very spooky, very challenging to catch. In fact, some of my favorite fishing for trout really anywhere in the world revolves around fishing the shallow margins of lakes and other still waters like that.
Yeah. Well, good, good. Well, we have Paul Staub and Hesperia wrote in, and I figured we'd get this out of the way right away because I know it would be something on all our minds, but let me just read what he wrote in. Living in Southern California, skinny water presents the greatest opportunity to fly fish without having to drive a great distance to get to larger systems. This is, of course, due to the lack of significant rainfall or snow to water our creek systems. This has also been a particularly dry year, and the creek and river systems are showing the effects. There are many out there who decry those that who would choose to fish these low water times. Just how much negative effect does one risk on the fish resource by fishing during these low water conditions? Or are we talking about different scenarios when we're talking about fishing skinny water?
Well, I think that what we're probably going to talk about tonight is less about fishing in stressed conditions, which technically, that would also keep skinny water, where you just have a very low late summer condition where the water temperatures are really jumping up, especially during the middle of the day and into the evening. In those cases, I would really look at the situation. And I lived in Southern California for a number of years and fished probably some of the same places that Paul is talking about. And I know how low they can get and how warm they can get. My real concern with approaching those types of places has to do with water temperature more than anything, at least initially. Once the water temp starts to get up, playing fish in that type of environment and, you know, releasing them back into very thin, very warm, perhaps poorly oxygenated water is not something that I personally would do. I've seen some of the effects of that over the years. Watch people fish in places they probably shouldn't, and you end up with dead fish. That said, if there are areas in the stream system that you're looking at that are spring-fed, that maybe have deeper, cooler pools, perhaps fishing only in the morning hours after the river has had time to cool overnight, those types of scenarios might open you up to some possibilities, even on some very thin late summer waters. But it's one of those things, I think, that I would definitely play with a thermometer, check out what's going on, know the species you're after, sort of know some of the critical water temperatures that they're dealing with, and I think I would play it safe and not stress the fish unnecessarily just because you want to go fishing.
Right, right. So that was, I guess that kind of answers my next question, which was going to be, you know, what's the difference between cold and warm skinny water? And what temperature range, you know, would you feel safe with?
Well, again, that's species dependent. So I think that if we're talking cold skinny water, we're talking, in my opinion, trout fishing and so forth, not really looking so much toward the skinny water where you might find really warm water species.
Right, right. Now, let's just talk about trout. Yeah.
Right. So if you're in a situation, excuse me, I'm just getting over a little late early season cold here, so I'm like have a few coughs to interrupt us. I think that when you're starting to talk temperatures, again, dependent on the trout species, but if you're talking temps that are creeping up into the 70s in particular, then it's probably time to find some other place to go. Even a high 60s, depending on the fish species, may be trouble.
Yeah, okay.
So I would definitely fish the thermometer and just, and I add air on the side of caution. I always like to do that. If I get out there and it's going to marginal, no, I can go practice casting or just do something else for the day.
Right.
I don't need this resource unnecessarily.
Right, right. Tim in La Grande, Oregon, or La Grande, I don't know how they say it up in Oregon, wrote in and asked, what's the differences in fishing skinny water, skinny tailwater rivers versus skinny freestone rivers? Do you see a difference there in approach? Or?
Certainly. I think one of the key differences really has to do with how those rivers are born, and that is the tailwater is really coming from an undershot dam. So it's going to be not necessarily uniform water level all year, but it certainly has a much more uniform temperature profile, even in very hot lake season conditions. Whereas a freestone stream, at least as we define it in fly fishing, is going to be much more influenced by ambient temperature and so forth, because it's just basically pouring from the watershed in general. I think that with that in mind, when I'm fishing a skinny tailwater, I'm probably thinking more about fishing, I don't want to say necessarily specific hatches, but I think that I focus quite a bit more on the type of insect life that you would expect in an environment where the insects themselves aren't particularly stressed. So when I'm fishing, you know, any kind of tailwater in the west, for instance, and there are plenty of them, I'm going to be looking basically at all times for hatches of things like midges and so forth. I know that the hatches will probably be a bit more consistent unless the tailwater's got a lot of fluctuation in it, in which case it might throw things off. But I know that when I go and fish a tailwater, skinny water situation, I'm probably going to be fishing over fish that are not as stressed necessarily and fish that are probably more comfortable in their environment just due to the fact that the day-to-day change in the water and the day-to-day change in weed growth and other things in terms of the seasonality aren't as dramatic as they are in a freestone system. In a freestone, you know, late-season type of fishing, my choice of fly patterns might differ. I might also be going very small for that, that may be necessary, but I might be looking more toward flies like terrestrials or considering fishing, you know, morning hours if the water temperature is getting up, in which case then I'm looking at, you know, what are the potential hatches from the morning up to a certain point during the day when the heat of the day comes on, that type of thing. Those are sort of the basic underlying differences between the two initially. Thin water is thin water either way, but I think that when you have a very consistent environment, you can rely more on a structured hatch cycle, you can rely more on certain types of insects being readily available all the time, and you can rely on fish being a little less skittish necessarily than they might be in a freestone system where all of a sudden fish that are used to a high runoff and a decent river flow during the middle of summer are suddenly finding themselves covered in, you know, razor-thin water and become hyper, hyper spooky. So those types of things would certainly drive some of the differences on how I would approach and view tailwater versus a freestone skinny water situation.
Right. Now, the way you speak, and you speak of hatches and so forth, I'm thinking of more of a stream or river situation of skinny water, but we also have skinny water in small streams where basically just the size of the stream itself makes it skinny water in many cases. But you have a different insect situation there, I think, the smaller streams. You don't have the hatches that you have on the larger streams. Am I right? And that warrant a different approach?
Yeah, you know, a small stream is a small stream, period. And there are a lot of places where you can fish where it's, like you said, it's going to necessarily be city water just because the flow itself is relatively small in comparison to something like a tailwater like we were just talking about.
Right.
In those cases, I would approach those streams looking at, you know, what the typical hatch cycle would be, unless we're talking something dramatic environmentally going on that would cause the water to really change in its character. And in a small stream, that could be pretty troublesome for the fish. But assuming that the stream is at normal flow levels, then I would certainly be looking at, you know, the standard hatches that I would expect and so forth on that water, because that's just the size of it. It's always getting. So the insects and so forth, and the fish are just used to living in a thin water environment. Those types of places, I think, oftentimes get approached as if they are big water, because we oftentimes use small streams, or at least small, faster streams, as being the domain of small, perhaps less wary fish. But I think that, for me personally, maybe one of the biggest considerations in approaching skinny water in terms of small streams of skinny water is to approach it with great care and standoff distance. You know, treat it as if it is that late season freestone where the fish all of a sudden are, you know, in razor thin, warm water, very, very sensitive to anything. And if you approach it that way, I can guarantee you that you'll probably discover there are many more and larger fish in those small, quote, skinny water streams than many anglers might have imagined.
Yeah, yeah. I know when I was, this was a few years ago when our national fly fishing team went over to Portugal to fish. And boy, did I hear the moaning and groaning about the challenging skinny water fishing over there. I guess there's a lot of it. With a lot of overhanging canopy trees that made it just super difficult, you know, for presentation. But
certainly.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's typical of, like, Portugal and Spain and those kinds of areas, but
I've fished some over in Europe in some of the sort of Mediterranean streams and so forth, and there can be some vapor-thin water, I'll tell you what, and some very spooky trout.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's when you combine a smooth flow, a low flow, and especially if we're talking rivers that are not tailwaters where the fish are used to their environment, we're talking waters that are dropping considerably in the late season, presentation of any kind becomes a real challenge. And that's, the presentation is as much as of anything, including your approach in terms of dealing with skinny water trout.
Right.
So it pays to work on casting and mending skills and so forth. We can talk about some of that.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's take a quick break now, though, and then we'll come back and we'll dig deeper into the skinny water. I don't know. Dig deeper into the skinny water. All right. This came out funny. Okay, we'll be right back. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips, spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com and view the fishing products and guide services they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, go to www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jason Borger about skinny water trout. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Jason, let's see here. We've got, one of the questions was, do the food sources differ in skinny water? And let's go away from the small stream thing here and back to the tailwaters, restone, that kind of stuff. But do the hatches change when the water gets skinny?
Well, I think that when we're talking skinny water in something like a freestone situation, or even if you have a tailwater where, for whatever reason, there might be a very long drawdown on the water flow, when you're talking minimum flows and that kind of thing, there can be an effect on normal hatch density, that type of thing. There may also be an effect on when the hatches are occurring. So it pays to know the insect that you're dealing with, and really pays to figure out whether or not that insect is going to be strongly affected by warmer water temperatures, if it means you're going to have to expect to hatch earlier or later or even at night, whatever the case may be. Obviously, the insects that are in a river are in a river. It's not like they're just going to vanish because of low water conditions. But I think that one of the insect groups that is probably quite important to the skinny water fly fisher, now we're talking late season here in terms of free zone and that type of thing, is definitely the terrestrials. And those really get into the water on a significant basis. They can be in the water in tailwater situations and still waters as well. And I've seen incredible ant falls on still waters in the late season, especially when we're cruising the edges looking for those ants. So anytime that I'm approaching skinny water and I know that I'm going to be there during a certain hatch time, I always like to call ahead or get a hold of somebody that I know and find out what's the hatch situation. You know, how is it this year? Is it strong? Is it, have the temperatures been really high? What's the water level looking like? Are the insects coming off in dribs and drabs? Or is there a really solid hatch going on between 10 and 2? Whatever the case may be. And it's important, I think, if you're going to go after, that type of situation, that you educate yourself ahead of time and don't just rely on, what happened last year. Because things can certainly change. And I also suggest that every skinny water trout fisherman probably has at least some ants, some beetles, and some griffiths and gnats in their box at all times, period. So with those three flies, you can do some amazing things in skinny water.
Okay. Do the food go, do the fish go off the feed as the temperature rises? Do you find they're feeding less?
Yeah, there can be situations where the temperature gets high enough that they become very stressed and aren't really going to be up and looking around. And again, you can also be in a situation where you might find a spring seabird or a coal or something where you've got fish that are being able to find some respite from the heat. Going in there and catching them and dragging them out into skinny hot water is probably not the best idea. So if I know the situation is going to be one of high temps and so forth, I can expect that I may end up fishing early morning hours. In fact, on some of the creeks in southern Wisconsin where I used to live, during the summer months, and these were spring creeks, but during the summer months, they would actually get warm up during the day, that by the time the evening rolled around, there weren't a lot of fish up and feeding. Some of the small guys would be out, but oftentimes the best fishing was after dark, once the river had a chance to cool a bit, and the fish were feeling a little bit more comfortable, or sometimes early in the morning, once the river had cooled all night, and was at its low temperature for the day, and then fish would certainly be more active then than they would in the heat of a 95-degree hot Wisconsin summer.
Yeah. You mentioned a minute ago, always have, what you said, Griffith's gnat, ants, and beetles, because they're always seem to be around in the late season and so forth. So do you find yourself using more dry flies on skinny water than nymphs?
I'd say that in skinny waters in general, and here we're just talking, it doesn't matter seasonality. It can be, spring, summer, fall, winter, whatever the case may be. Oftentimes, surface flies or film flies would be a go-to initially, just because, in skinny water, I'm not talking 3 feet deep. I'm talking, sometimes a foot, sometimes less than that. I've fished places where I've cast a fish that were actually swimming along with their dorsal or tail fin sticking out, looking for food. In those cases, plopping a nymph down in front of them, especially a weighted nymph or something with a bead head or something else on it, is oftentimes the wrong move. Those fish can be very, very spooky. They're on high alert. Particularly in a situation where got low flows, fish are in a tail out of a pool, for instance, very exposed. Midday, you've got a bright sun. And those types of situations, just a flip of a fly going in, even the splash of a leader sometimes, you don't get a chance. That can send them scurrying for cover. So usually if I'm in a situation where I know the fish are probably just up and looking, maybe they're looking for midges, or there's going to be, some terrestrials coming down. Maybe there's been an off-again, on-again hatch of little mayflies or something along those lines. I'll fish either a surface fly, which is great because it's, it's all visible. You get to see fly floating down. Hopefully the fish takes. Or I'll fish a film fly, something in that upper inch or so of the water column. Tiny nymph, of course, is not out of the question at all. In fact, plenty of skinny water trout on small nymphs. But I kind of shy away from heavy flies. Maybe that's what I should say, versus just saying, surface flies or film flies. It's really the heavy fly that I tend to shy away from just because of the way they go in. And in fact, you're talking such thin water anyway. a fly that's got any kind of weight to it's going to the bottom in a hurry, unless, of course, you're giving a lot of action, which, again, is probably not what those fish are after. That's not to say that you couldn't fish a larger fly. I've got an example from, a number of years ago, maybe 10 years back, vividly in my mind. You'll know why here in a second. I was fishing a shallow lake margin, and by this, I mean this shallow lake margin was wadeable out probably 100, 120 feet. So it was skinny water all the way. And it was early morning, but very, very bright sun. So the fish were up and looking for food, but they were chunky. And it was really a hands and knees kind of exercise for most of the fish that were close in. And they were sipping midges, you know, a few of the other little insects that pop off, like little calabatus, that type of thing. They were not really looking for anything in particular. It was just one of those good mornings to be out there. And the fish were taking sort of whatever came along. So it was kind of one of those Griffith's Gnat types of mornings. And as we got a little bit further along, I could see out there maybe 70 or 80 feet. And at the first, my eyes were deceiving me, but I realized I was looking at a very, very large brown trout that was cruising out sort of at that limit, right where the flat kind of dipped off into a big, deeper water. I didn't think he was going to come up and take a Griffith's Gnat, so I actually switched over and put on a big dragonfly nymph, but it was not a heavy fly. It was completely marabou. So the fly in hand was very, very light. In fact, by far and away, the heaviest part of the fly was the hook. And, of course, I immediately lashed that on, not thinking, clearly, at the time. Well, I went from basically fishing Griffith's Gnats with 5X to lashing this thing on, made the cast, put it in front of the fish. The fly, being marabou, landed very, very softly on the water, just settled. So the fish really wasn't spooked by, you know, something heavy entering the water, but it was still a big fly. It looked good and juicy, you know, some nice calories. Gave the fly a couple of strips, and that fish came over and took it. I set the hook, and it was like I set the hook on a wall. And all of a sudden, fish gave one head shake. Boom. That was it. Snap. 5X is gone instantly, of course. And the fish just sort of shook its head a couple of times and moved back off into deeper water. And it would have been the fish of the trip easily. It was a brown that was, I'll step up there and throw the fishing tail out and say it was, you know, one of those 8 to 10 pound fish. Those ones you don't see very often during the season. And had a perfect shot at it in skinny water and got it to take on a very large but very, very lightweight fly. So I think that if you're approaching skinny water fish, no matter what the situation, thinking light first is probably a good way to go, whether it's a surface fly or a sinking fly like a small nymph or even something, you know, huge like a dragonfly nymph.
Yeah, thinking soft and quiet.
Soft and quiet. I think there's a lot of CDC that gets thrown in skinny waters for that very reason. It just has a great buggy look, but it's just very soft, sort of very quiet, if you want to think of it that way. Small flies, and like I said, they don't necessarily have to be dry flies, but something that's just not making a harsh entry and looks like something good to eat. That's probably the most important thing. Unless you've got a strong hatch situation where you're definitely matching a hatch, going with something that's got good silhouette, something that looks buggy, whether that's something like a Griffith's Gnat or something like an ant pattern, which can double for all sorts of things, not just ants. I mean, an ant pattern can look like an ant. It can look like a little spinner. It can look like a little nymph in the surface film, all those types of things. And I think that beetles also, small beetles, we're talking like 14, 16, 18, 20s, sometimes even smaller, they also have a very nice surface impression, and it's a type of a food source that the fish are oftentimes seeing. And I've fished those types of flies, not just in the late season. I know we were talking a bit about late season fishing here because that's oftentimes when you have skinny water, but I've fished those types of flies also much earlier in the season in places like spring creeks where, you know, the water temp may be quite cold, but the fish are only holding in a few inches of water. So, again, you're using what many anglers would view as, for example, late season freestone tactics, but you're fishing, you know, a spring creek situation where the approach has to be very cautious and measured. And you want a fly that is going to, you know, enter the water as softly as possible and not really present itself as something greatly out of the ordinary.
Where do you find the fish in skinny water? Do they move to different flies than normally would be in deeper water?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on what the situation is. Again, going back to our first question, or second question, about changes between, you know, tailwaters and freestone systems,
right,
that type of thing. And tailwaters, really, you can in many ways view those as spring creeks. Again, if they have very large fluctuations, there's some differences there. But if it's a tailwater that's got reasonably constant flow, you're looking at something that's that has very many of the Spring Creek characteristics, so you can kind of put those together when you're thinking about them. You know, in those situations, you're going to find the fish in, you know, all the usual spots, because for them, it's not a water temperature issue, and it's not a change in structure that you would experience when you have large changes in water flow over the space of a year. So in those situations, when I go in the Spring Creek or Tailwater, I'm looking for fish in all the usual spots. I mean, I'm looking for them, you know, in channels, looking for them, you know, along the sides of a log, undercut banks, overhanging grasses, particularly during midday, although fish will certainly be out right dead center midday. I mean, if you go to New Zealand sometime and you fish some of those spring creeks and there, gosh, there's a 6-pound brown out at high noon, basically sitting right out in the middle of a spring creek. It's a pretty awesome sight.
Wow.
But a lot of times the fish, once the sun is really up, may move to some situation or a position where they feel a little bit more comfortable, whether it's next to something or under some overhanging grasses or that type of thing. But again, usual suspects when I'm fishing those types of waters. When it comes to freestone streams or perhaps, you know, another stream that's a tailwater that sees huge amounts of fluctuation, I fish in the tailwaters in Arkansas, and, man, there's some places where there's bone dry, you know, 1 minute, and they found the horn, and not too much later, you couldn't stand there. It's gone. So in those situations, yeah, the fish are going to get moved around a whole lot. That's almost better fished with somebody that knows the water the first couple of times you do it and understands what's happening and where the fish are going. But if you think that fish always need a couple of things, you know, they always need some shelter from current. So if you're looking behind rocks, you're looking behind riprap, fallen trees that are in, obviously, along the edges, behind boulders, that type of thing. You know, fish are going to move to those spots, or very deep water, but it's just down underneath the main current flow, you know, bottoms of deep pools and that type of thing. You know, you're going to do okay, but then again, you know, all of a sudden it's not so much skinny water, now it becomes a deep water. But a few hours later, it may become skinny again. So in those situations, yeah, those kind of tailwater fishers have to be used to doing both kinds of fishing in a day. If you're talking about a freestone situation where the water level is simply drawing down as the season goes on, yeah, sure, fish are going to move from their normal spots. I mean, I've fished freestones where I've stood where I've caught fish earlier in the season. That's not unusual. And those fish will tend to congregate more into deeper pools, slots, that type of situation where they've got a little bit better water temperature, a little bit better oxygenation, that type of thing. That said, if there's enough food out there and the fish are comfortable enough, you may get them coming out into, you know, fairly open water. I'm talking like big flats, for instance, where you have a much more constant water depth. So even if the water's drawing down, you're not getting these big exposed areas, you know, and this channelization going on. You're just getting lower water. That's all you're getting. Same general size overall, just skinnier and skinnier and skinnier. And when the fish are up feeding in those situations, particularly in the tailouts of flats and that type of thing, you have to approach very carefully. You really need to think about what you're doing to even have a shot at those fish. I remember one time I was fishing in New York, upstate New York when I was a kid, and I fished a late season flat. It was August. And I looked at this thing, and I figured, you know what, there's not going to be a fish out there. It's the middle of the day. It's hot. Whatever. I went charging in, and two beautiful big browns. And, you know, they were clear as day right in front of me, and they were probably 20 inches apiece. These were big fish, especially for this river. They took one look at me and bolted past me full speed. And they had been out there sitting in the tail of that flat, bright sun, and they had just been feeding away just very quietly doing their thing. And I, of course, you know, as a kid, just went charging in thinking, oh, there's no fish in there. Toom, and away they went. I never forgot that lesson.
Yeah, I hope your dad wasn't around.
He wasn't. He would have been screaming of agony, though. As I watched him with my mouth agape as they just went flying past me down to the next riffle and into the lower pools. They had obviously come up there. There were some, during this time, there was a little hatch going on, and they had come up, and they were just sitting there just picking at stuff. And
you ruined their day. You ruined
their
day.
And ruined mine, too. Look, the biggest fish I caught today was probably 14 inches, you know, 14 inches off of the rainbow, and it was an incredible brown that had been right in front of me, and I hadn't even bothered to take the time to look at the skinny water just a little bit more carefully. But those are good lessons to learn as a kid, because as an adult, you need to go a little slower.
Yeah. Your cell phone is kind of like breaking up a little bit there. I don't know if you're moving around or what, but...
Is that okay there?
Yeah. So.
Okay.
What about water going barren at times of the year? I know I did an interview with John Harp, and he's a guy down on the Canoes River in southern Colorado. And he said in parts of the Canoes, basically, you know, because of the low water flow, Lake Chazen will become barren and the fish move downriver. And then he finds the fish will move back up later in the fall when the water rises. I'm asking that because that poses a whole new question about are there fish there in the skinny water? And I guess, you know, I would assume that most of the time when you're fishing skinny water, you're sight fishing just because it's skinny water and you can see things. Is that
a lot of times you are, yeah. You're either sight fishing or you're fishing to rises that you can see. It can be surprisingly difficult to see fish, even in very thin water, depending on your angle and their size and so forth. But I think this question, or sort of this discussion about the fact that Canoes gets barren at times and there's no fish, probably has as much to do with fishing with a thermometer as anything. And
okay.
I think that having a thermometer and being able to find out what the water temp really is may tell you some things right away about whether or not you're going to have a successful day or if you're going to get some casting practice in. And if
that
you're in a situation where,
if
you're dipping that thermometer in and it just keeps coming back, you know, 70, 72, 74, unless it's a highly tolerant strain of fish that's in there, they are probably not going to be there. If they have an escape route, they'll probably take it. Again, you might be able to find some spring seeps or something, but if it were me and I was fishing that situation and it was just dead water and I found a few fish that were hiding out, I don't know if I'd fish for them. I just don't want to risk dragging them into that hot water, and especially when they're tired from having been played.
Right.
So, again, I think the skinny water angler needs to buy a thermometer. They're cheap, and use it.
Yeah,
it can make
a
pretty significant difference.
Yeah, and then you can use it other times of the year, too.
Definitely.
Where you could make a difference, yeah. Let's take a quick break.
It can always make a difference.
Yeah,
you're absolutely correct. I think that many of the anglers out there who are tuned into the water temperature are probably saying, yeah, I use my thermometer all the time. It's not just for skinny water trout, and they're absolutely right.
Yeah.
The thermometer can make a big difference for you.
No, a lot of guys are hanging them off their float tubes, you know, in the lakes and searching for the temperature in the water column there. So.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and in lakes, it's interesting, too, because you can get skinny water on one end of the lake and skinny water on the other end of the lake, and one area of skinny water will have no fish, and the other area will be full of fish, and it's completely due to the temperature. I've fished lakes where the wind had been blowing for a significant period of time in the middle of summer, and I'm not talking low water conditions here. I'm just talking the lakes at normal level, but we're fishing the near shore margins. So this is essentially, you know, flats fishing for trout is what it really is. And when you're at the end where the water was sort of piling up from being blown downwind over and over and over for hours, that water was getting very warm. Sun was heating on it. It just kept piling up, and pretty soon, you know, fish weren't there anymore. And you throw the thermometer in, you're like, oh, 72. That might explain something. You go around to the other end of the lake, which is in the shade, and you know, underneath the pines, and the wind sort of blowing away from it, and you can find fish being there, and the water temperature was fine. So, you know, just looking at the situation in general, especially in a place like a still water where wind can really have an effect, also is, you know, worth it to the skinny water angler to pay attention to.
Yeah. We'll take a quick break here, but I got a question about the wind situation in trout. So as soon as we come back, I'll ask you that.
Okay, great.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jason Borger about skinny water trout. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Jason, what you made me start thinking about is we were on a fishing trip up in northern Manitoba on a big lake. We're fishing for pike, and walleye. And one day there was just a constant wind that's picking up and kind of maybe working into a storm situation. But the guide took us over to a little bay where you could say it was skinny water, shallow water. And what had happened was, I guess the constant moving of the water and the wind pushing it into that bay pushed a lot of bait fish into that bay and into the shallows. And it turned into just a feeding frenzy for the pike. They were just knocking this bait fish all over the place. You'd throw your fly out there, and when it hit the water, bait fish would pop up like popcorn into the air from the fright. And we just knocked them dead then for about an hour there. Now, I'm wondering, will trout do the same kind of thing with bait fish? Would you ever find trout in a similar situation?
Definitely.
Yeah?
No doubt about it. Absolutely. I've fished those types of situations. Now, not a situation probably as intense as what you're describing, where you've got all these bait fish that are rammed in this one area, and you have all these predatory pike there just going bonkers in there. That must have been pretty exciting, actually.
Oh, it was
I would have been up for that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Exciting, yeah.
But I certainly have fished in a number of places, and not just still waters in terms of what we think of as lakes, but sometimes sloughs and other areas of flowing systems, but mostly, I would say, in lakes, ponds, and other places like that, where you'll get concentrations of bait fish, and sometimes they'll get piled up by the wind, you know, wave action crashing in, sort of pushing them into place, that type of thing. And you get a number of trout that'll get in there and just start to tear them up. And they will bolt in, you know, full speed, like barracuda coming in there and just crash them. I've seen it with brown trout, rainbow trout, you know, a number of different trout species doing this exact same behavior. In fact, one time I saw several brown trout that had corralled a bunch of bait fish on a real shallow, sandy slope on a lake. And it was midday, maybe, like 2 in the afternoon. So it was full-on hot, bright sun. Wind had already kicked up for the day, so the waves were coming in pretty good. And these two fish just practically turned themselves inside out. I think they were getting a little bit bloodlusty almost going after these bait fish. And one of these browns shot completely out of the water right up onto the sandy bank. Right out, chasing the fish. And I sort of looked at him, and he kind of looked at me, and gave himself a couple of shakes, and he was back in, and away he went. So, you know, this is a series of lakes I've fished a lot over the years, and both my father and myself have sort of come up with a tactic when that happens. Oftentimes, if we have a sinking fly on, or even a floating fly, if it's a big enough one, we'll just immediately, if we're close enough, cast as hard onto the surface as we can with a fly. Exactly the opposite of what you're supposed to do in about 99.9% of skinny water trout fishing situations, right? Well, in this case, it's exactly what you need because you're trying to get the fish's attention. And occasionally, especially if the fish are something like a damsel nymph or something along with a snail, something that's got a little weight to some surface fly, occasionally you pop a fly in front of one of those fish and give it a good hard strip, maybe you can get one. I've only gotten a few of them over the years. Mostly I actually just like to watch the spiteful reef trout coming in and just crashing these bait fish and then tearing back out into deep water. It's actually a pretty cool thing to see as you're fishing.
Your phone is breaking up again. I don't know if you can fix anything on your end, but it kind of goes in and out. I don't know what's happening. Okay, good, good. Well, yeah, that just brought to mind, and I didn't know if trout would kind of corral bait fish and do that kind of thing, but obviously they do, and makes for an exciting hour, too, that's for sure, always.
It does.
Yeah. So let's talk about presentation. You know, I guess that's what it comes down to, is you've got skinny water, they can see you, they're spooky, they're worried about everybody and their brother, you know, every hawk, eagle, and, you know, predator that can see them and might, you know, go after them. So how do we keep, you know, what's our approach, and how do we keep from being seen?
Well, probably the best advice I could give. Am I coming through okay in this position?
Yeah, it's okay, yeah.
Okay. Probably the best advice that I could give, just generally speaking, is to be the heron. By that, I mean literally watch what herons do and duplicate it. Oftentimes, our approach, and I'm not just talking skinny water here, but it could really be anything. Our approach is oftentimes too rushed, without enough attention being paid to the details. And if you look at how a heron fishes, obviously they have to quickly get into position, but once they're into position, then everything is slow and low, everything takes time, all about watching and having patience. And when it comes to skinny water trout, I think that's one of the single most important things that really any anglers can do, and that is to mimic that type of behavior. Sometimes you have to move fast. Of course you do. I mean, heron has to fly in, right? That's fine. But then once you're there, take the extra time to really watch what's going on. I mean, the temptation is always you see a fish rise or you see a fish swimming, you'll cast right away, especially if they're cruising in the still water. You think they might be moving into deeper water, whatever the case may be. The temptation is always to go right away because there they are. But if you take a little extra time and ease yourself into position. Just remember, my father always has a saying, he said, fish know you're there, big fish always know. And I think it goes doubly so in skinny waters. Doesn't matter what you're fishing for. Big fish always know you're there. So treat each fish that way, like they're a big fish. Ease yourself into position. Really see what they're doing. What's their behavior? I mean, what are they really up to? Do they have a set pattern? Are they rising two or three times, then going down for a minute or two, coming back up, rising two or three times? Once you begin to see what the fish is doing, that gives you a little bit better idea about how you want to make your presentation. It may also give you a little bit of extra time to sort of figure out what the best angle might be. Maybe you want to change where you're at, that type of thing. So be the heron. In addition to that, I always tell people, don't ever assume blind spots. Don't ever assume that staying low makes you invisible. Assume only one thing, and that is that the fish can see you and act accordingly. So always assume, especially in skinny waters, especially skinny flat waters, that the fish is going to be able to see you and then act accordingly. And, of course, acting accordingly is be the heron. If you can do those two things, you'll definitely be well ahead of the game. Patience is a virtue, right?
Yep, yep. When you say be the heron, okay, that's move slow. I'm taking that as moving slowly and moving into position. But then you're faced with having to move your arm and your rod, right?
Yes, you are.
So
when it comes time for the heron to strike, the heron gets into position and then makes one good strike, right? So we have to do the same thing as fly fishers. We need to think about what we're going to do and be proactive about how we do it before the time arrives for us to actually pull a line off the reel and make the cast. In a lot of skinny water situations, whether it's skinny water due to literally low water at the end of the season, or it's simply skinny water because it's margins of a river or a lake or a spring creek situation, if you put a bad cast over the fish, they're gone. So you've got to put a good cast over the fish, and preferably you want to put a cast over the fish and let the fly behave in the way the fish is expecting. And typically when we're talking about skinny water situations, at least in flowing skinny waters, we're talking about oftentimes a dead drift, or what's oftentimes called a reduced drag or drag-free drift, if you can manage that. Sometimes a fly might need to have a little bit of motion, but that's situation-specific. So what you want to be able to do is set up the cast and potentially an aerial mend so that by the time the fly lands, it is landing fishing. You're not doing something else to it to try to get it to look right. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Sure. No mending on the water. That would be deadly, I could say.
I would consider, in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, I would consider on-the-water mending to really be a secondary, maybe not even secondary, something you shouldn't even do. But it definitely is a secondary approach, technique. Aerial mending is really where it's at. When I say the fly lands ready to fish, that means it lands, all the slack is on the water that you need for a drag-reduced or drag-free drift, and the only thing that has to happen is the fly just has to get to the fish. If you can achieve that, especially in flowing water conditions, you're way ahead of the game. Yes, sometimes in a place like a still water, you may need to cast the fly out. Maybe you give it a little twitch. Just a little tiny bit of movement so the fish zeroes in on it. Then you leave it alone and let the fish come to the fly. Skinny water techniques and skinny water approaches are definitely about subtlety first. You can always add more later, but it's hard to take it away once you've done it. So if you've added too much at the beginning, you can't subtract it out. You may have already spooked the fish or put the fish off that fly. So start subtle and work your way up if you have to.
Do you find, just for the fact of trying to stay hidden, do you find yourself making longer casts than you normally would, or is that all the same and you're just in stealth mode? Do you try to keep short and tight with your casts?
I would prefer to make casts that are as short as feasible. And that's just because you have better control.
Right.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Sometimes the shortest feasible can be a long, long ways. So that becomes situation dependent. If I can get closer by crouching down, by breaking up my silhouette, by casting sidearm, and so forth, then I'll get as close as I possibly can. If I don't have any cover, I'll still try to get low, but I may have to make a longer cast. That's just the way it is. So casting skills become paramount.
I guess what you said it right in the beginning, it's control, you know. The shorter the cast, the more control you have. The longer the cast, the less control you have, and the more things that can go wrong,
including
currents and all kinds of things. But we always think, you know, so many times that you have to make that 40-foot cast when you only need a 25-foot cast, you know, if you just do it right and in control. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, the better control you have, the better off you're always going to be.
So can you describe some of the presentations you might use in skinny water, whether, when I say presentations, whether it's in a stealthy crawling approach or whether it's a particular kind of cast that you like using skinny water that gives you more options?
I guess one of the first things I would say is keep it low, or low as you reasonably can. That's oftentimes something in sidearm or elliptical. That's not always necessary or actually feasible. You may not be able to make a sidearm cast just due to the situation. But I like to keep the fly rod in line as low as I can while I'm making any kind of skinny water presentation. In fact, if the fish are really close, I'll use something like a bow and arrow cast, which means the rod really doesn't move at all. All I'm doing is drawing it back and using it as a bow and just sort of shooting the line out. You know, you can reach 20 feet or so doing that. And it keeps the line definitely out of the fish's vision as much as possible. You know, reduce your false cast as much as possible. I know that, you know, shadow casting may make the giant Montana rainbows rise, but in most cases, skinny water trout will run. So I don't recommend that. Yeah, a conservation of movement is, I think, paramount when it comes to any kind of presentation in terms of the actual cast itself. And keeping it low, trying to keep it just as, you know, as least obvious as possible is probably the best thing you can hope for. I also then use certain sets of mends that I think probably every skinny water angler ought to know, and those are the four really foundation reach mends. They're aerial mends, not on the water mends. They're right, left, up, and down. And sometimes they're called reach casts if you're going right or left, but really they're made once the line loop is already traveling toward target, and you then reach the rod and thus the line in some direction, right, left, up, or down. Those four, I think, are really key for any skinny water angler, particularly in flowing waters, less so in still waters, but flowing waters, definitely.
Okay, good. Let's take another quick break here, and then we'll come back and finish up here. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Jason Borger about skinny water trout. If you'd like to ask Jason a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to send in your question. We'll try to answer as many of the questions tonight as possible. Okay, here's the question from Ron in Ridgewood. I don't know where Ridgewood is, but it says, how do you fish skinny water when there are no rises? Seems like getting the right presentation is nearly impossible. I'm assuming he's talking when he's saying the right presentation. I'm wondering if he's talking about, you know, some kind of nymph fishing as opposed to the dry fly fishing.
Okay. Well, if you're fishing skinny water and, you know that there are fish there, let's establish that, number one. You can see fish out there and they're nymphing. In fact, I fished a very, very skinny part of the Green River in Utah a number of years back, and really it was between ankle and knee deep at the most. There were a lot of fish that were in this tail out to this big flat. And they were in there, and they were not looking for anything up top. There's really nothing going on. But they were certainly feeding, so they were looking for nymphs and that type of thing. And, you know, you could pitch a dry fly with them all day. It wasn't going to do you much good. Occasionally you might get a fish, but if you want them, you had to get out with a nymph. And in that situation, you're really You're going to be setting yourself up to use what one might call a fly suspension device. I'll explain what that is. That's the fly fisherman's term for bobber. No, yes, actually, but there are other ways to suspend a fly than just a giant puffball, okay? Sure, you can use an indicator. Typically, in an instance like that, if I knew that the fish were taking whatever type of nymph might be in the water column, let's just say I'm going to fish a size 16 PP because that looks like a lot of stuff. So I'm going to try that first. I don't necessarily know what's going on, but a size 16 PP, that usually looks tasty to most trout. I'm going to fish that. I might fish it under a little tuft of white wool or synthetic wool as an indicator. Maybe a little tuft of white mixed with black, something like that. Just enough to hold the fly at depth. Obviously, if you pitch the fly up there and it goes under and it continues down to the bottom, well, you're kind of out of luck. You really have to hold the fly at the right depth. You can't just pitch it up there and hope. Yeah, you might be able to get it at just the right distance so it intersects the fish, you know, right on its face, and boom, away you go. But that can be tough sometimes, and you can end up hooking the bottom a lot and doing that type of thing. I'd much rather know that my fly was held at a certain depth, particularly when the bottom is so close like it is in skinny waters. So a little tufted indicator like that, just enough to hold the fly. It doesn't have to be anything more than that. And I would probably drop the fly down on the tippet that I would like to fish it on, let's say 6X, but I would actually have the indicator tied up, let's say 6 or 8 inches away, on maybe a piece of 4X. So the tippet itself, the final tip is not very long, just enough to fish the fly. And the indicator itself might be up on 4X, or something equivalent in terms of strength. So I'm not trying to cast and deal with and manipulate this long length of very thin tippet material. Probably not really necessary in that particular situation. So that'd be one approach, one possibility. Another thing you could do is grease the leader, and what I did actually fishing that flat in Utah was exactly that. I was fishing a little nymph, and ended up greasing the leader out to about 8 inches of the fly, something like that, and cast out to the fish that way, and I actually fished down and across. I didn't fish up to the fish. I preferred that because I could cast out, and I could easily see the track of the leader on the water surface, but the fly was sinking. And essentially what I had done, you know, when you grease a leader, sounds very old-fashioned and technical and old-school, but, you know, when you grease a 9-foot leader, do you know what you've made? You made a 9-foot-long monofilament bobber. That's exactly what you have made. So there's nothing too romantic about it, but what it does do is it suspends the fly at a certain depth and allows you to have really good control. I'm a pretty smaller fly, so obviously you're not going to suspend a 5-piece stone fly with, a big bead head on it or whatever. For this type of fishing, it's exactly what you need. And you can follow the leader track easily, and by fishing down and across, I was able to slide the fly into position above the fish, and then simply drop the rod tip, allow the fly to go down, basically fly first, quartering into the fish, and then all I had to do was either watch the fish and watch them either open their mouth or turn or whatever, and I could also watch the end of the leader, and the leader's only 8-10 inches away from the fly, so if that thing twitches or moves at all, I know the fish is taken. Typically, in those kind of situations, I do like to watch the fish as much as I can, watch its behavior. That probably tells me more than anything. But that proved to be quite successful in that situation. So it was a greased leader with a small fly. The fish are really, really spooky and spooking off the leader. Well, you have some other options, too. Maybe you try even a tiny dry and dropper combination, something along those lines, where you fish maybe a Griffith's gnat that's suspending the pheasant tail or something along those lines, and I've certainly fished that combination before as well. So there are some options available to you, and I think that many times a down and across presentation in those types of skinny water situations can certainly be useful. It helps you to avoid lining the fish versus casting upstream, and allows you to have that little bit extra cushion where you can slide the fly into a position you deem best and then allow it to drift down to the fish.
Great. Yeah, I've used that dry dropper with a dry and then a film, emerger type situation.
Sure.
And that's worked really good because it's still all lightweight, and I knew they weren't feeding on the dries, so it was a way to get that fly out there and a delicate touch and yet have something subsurface for them to look at. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the only issue that people need to be aware of when you're fishing more than one fly is that, you do have an extra hook out there which can hook up on stuff. And I have lost, fish over the years. In fact, probably anybody that fishes more than one fly will have stories about that, about losing fish or getting themselves hooked when the fish comes in, or, you know, a number of things that can happen when you're fishing multi-flat rigs. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And something else to think about from a rigging perspective is also tippet rings, which have become popular in the last few years, and that will allow you to very easily run a small indicator or something off of one part of the ring and drop your fly off the other part, and fish that is also a very lightweight rig,
right,
which gives you the indicator and dropper without having to grease the leader or do some of those other types of things.
Right, right. Okay, another question came in from Brian Adams at Bakersfield. It says, while fishing the frying pan in Colorado, I assume, the fish were stacked on an inside corner about 3 inches of water. You could see their dorsal and tail sticking out of the water. They were not eating off the surface. What's the best way to fish that shallow downstream drift reach cast? How would you approach that?
Assuming the fish were all in there actually feeding and not rammed in there for some other reason, I'm not sure what the reason would be, but typically if there's a bunch of fish in a situation where they're kind of stacked up and sort of in reels, skinny water like that, I want to make sure first that they're feeding and there's not something else that's going on. It might be unusual, but assuming, yes, that they are on the fin, so to speak, and looking for food, I would probably approach that, well, I guess it would depend a bit on current, number one, and where I could stand in relation to the fish. But I would definitely want a crossing approach of some kind, not straight across, I don't think, either an up crossing or down across. A down across, of course, is always nice because you can position the fly very easily and then drop it into the fish. And I would probably start with a fish on the outside of that corner just to see what the response is. I know sometimes it's a temptation to flock sheep and put a fly down through the middle of them, which maybe you're going to get a fish, maybe you're going to snag a fish, and maybe you're going to get the bottom and wind up, you know, pulling a line tight across a bunch of them, they all spook out of there, which I have seen happen in the past, where, you know, one fish goes and they all go. So I would start on the very outside fish and work my way in and just see what the response is. You know, if they're down there nymphing and chowing down on stuff, either, in, like I said, an up and across or a down and across, depending on what the current flow is, what your backcast space looks like, you know, however you can get the most controlled presentation is how I would probably approach it. Unless there's something unusual going on with the river structure right there, I mean, you're sort of forced into doing, you know, one particular type of presentation. And again, avoid the temptation to flock shoot. You know, work on the outside fish, or if you're starting from, you know, down below, maybe there are a couple of fish that are sort of lower into that corner. Try a few casts to those fish first before trying to move up and catch maybe one of the larger fish that might be elsewhere in that pod.
Right, right. Okay, Jason in Denver, Colorado, says, I fished 11 Mile Canyon past weekend along with skinny water and extra skittish fish. It was weed choked with still green vegetation. Lanes between the weeds held no fish. Dry merger trailer rig was the go-to presentation most of the time. But he says, and what were deeper, or deep sections, deeper, not deep, I guess still skinny water, that were left didn't hold many fish. So I guess his question was, you know, what would he do in that situation? He's got weed choked. The channels, the lanes between seem to hold no fish. Where are the fish, and how would you fish that kind of water?
Well, it is a good question. I would love to see the situation. It would probably depend a little bit on what I was able to suss out myself once I got there.
No.
You know, I've fished places similar to what he's described. I've fished 11 Mile, but I've also fished other places similar to that and had experiences that would be along those same lines where you've got obvious channels, which is where the fish should be. There aren't any fish visible, and you're not seeing any fish rising anywhere else. You know, where are they? How do I get them? I actually fished a place that would be very similar in terms of frustration level called Hot Creek in sort of central California up in the Sierra. And I'm sure some of the people listening to the show probably fished it as well. And it can get very channelized like that. Lots of weeds that are making very, very skinny water, crazy skinny, like 1 inch deep. There would be deep channels in between, and at sometimes during the day, there are no fish. They're there, but they are not up and looking around. And they may or may well be down on the bottom along those weed edges and so forth. Maybe some fish that are nymphing down there. Usually you can see them if they're out and about doing that because they're moving back and forth and, you know, sort of actively scanning the water column, even if it's on the bottom. But if you're not seeing that, I'd say, you know, those fish either are tucked underneath the weeds for the time being, and maybe you'll see them again come evening. I know I've fished 11 Mile when you swear you couldn't buy a fish, and then evening showed up, and all of a sudden they were everywhere. You know, where did they come from? They didn't come out of holes in the ground, that's for sure. They were out there the whole time. The fish may also be back underneath some cover. They could be tucked underneath other type banks. There's a spring creek in Wisconsin I used to fish a lot. And seriously, it was the same type of situation. You would think that there was nothing but 8-inch brook trout and little tiny browns in this stream. Come about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, things changed a little bit, and as soon as darkness fell, all of a sudden, you know, the fish that could eat the 8-inch long brook or brown trout came out. And they were right in the pool you had been standing in 3 hours earlier. They were right there. Mm-hmm. They were just tucked back underneath undercuts and that type of thing.
And off the feed,
so,
I take it, yeah.
And off the feed, yeah. They're not looking around for anything. They're just parked, resting. So it could be that you've gotten a situation where there just wasn't anything to get them out. And there wasn't enough nymph activity going on. Especially if you're saying, yeah, I can see the bottom and I'm not seeing anything moving. You know, if there were fish out there nymphing, you'd see a few here or there. So they may just have been tucked away at that time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, okay. Okay, well, good. Now, just to kind of close things out, Jason, are there any parting words or advice about skinny water you want to relay to the folks before we finish up?
Yeah, I guess that if you view skinny water trout fishing as the heron, which we talked about earlier, and really put that behavior to work in your fishing. That means slow everything down, make every cast count, preferably one cast if you can make it happen, not 20 over the fish, which will probably put the fish down. Make one good one. Take the time to actually watch what's going on. I know the temptation is to cast, especially if you've got a feeding fish in front of you, if you've got a fish that's cruising a shoreline, temptation is to cast immediately. But unless you really know what's going on, I don't suggest doing that. I suggest just taking that heron time and watching just a little bit. Figure out what's really happening. Figure out the best possible place to cast from, the best possible intercept point. And maybe your upstream presentation really will help you more of a down and across presentation. That might help you more. And that type of thing from an approach and presentation standpoint will really help you. Learn to make good controlled casts and learn four mends. Reach to the right, reach to the left, reach up, and reach down. That's called, sometimes called a reach cast to the left, reach cast to the right. A puddle or pile cast, which is aimed high and the rod tip is dropped downward, which results in S-curves on the water. And the reach up, which is sometimes called a parachute mend or parachute cast. It's good for downstream approach where you cast, let the line loop past you, reach the rod tip up in the air and allow the line to just sort of gently parachute to the water and then feed the line down to the fish, the fly down to the fish. If you can do those four mends and approach like a heron, you have a big advantage in skinny water trout. And also remember, when you're fishing skinny water trout, if all the water is skinny, the fish have to be there somewhere, right? Unless they're completely gone, there are fish there somewhere. Remember that 12-year-old boy fishing in New York when he waded into the tail of that pool, thinking he can't get any fish here. Yeah, all the water trout was still there. So keep it in mind.
There you go. Okay.
Keep it in mind that the fish are still going to be there somewhere, and sometimes they're going to be right in front of you. Just take that time to observe and be patient.
Good, good. All right, great advice, great advice. Thanks, Jason. Well, we'll wrap things up now. Stick with me here, Jason, because we're going to give away that book of yours and your father's. And we're also going to be giving away a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So the one book of the series that we're going to be giving away from Jason and his father Gary is The Angler as Predator, which would be a good book to have, considering that we just talked about as well, to kind of sharpen up your predator skills here. So stick with us here for a couple more minutes. We're going to give away those gifts and close things up. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, and nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and the hopes of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support the retreat, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or you can call them at 866-237-5725. It's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd greatly appreciate it. Okay, now it's time to give away some prizes. Winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database, so if you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show, and then you won't miss out on some of these great gifts we have to give away. And if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Great organization to be a part of and to support. So our winner there is Eric Seal. Eric Seal in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Eric, and I know you'll enjoy that membership. Now we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at AmatoBooks.com. That's www.AmatoBooks.com. So check them out. They've got a lot of great books, as well as a Fly Fishing and Tying Journal as well. And our winner for that is Robert Atkins in Georgia. Robert Atkins in Georgia. So congratulations, Robert. Let me just get that name. I don't lose it here. We're good to go there. Okay, so let's ask a question here. And the winner will win The Angler as Predator, written by Gary Borger and illustrated by Jason Borger. So a great prize to win tonight. So you have the text box on our homepage. You need to type in the answer to this question I'm going to ask. This question actually has four answers here. So the first thing is Jason mentioned a tool that he thinks every angler should have, especially in skinning water, and use it more often. That's one of the answers I'm looking for. The other is, what are the three flies that he said that he thinks every skinning water fisherman should have in his box when you go out fishing in skinning water? Okay, those three flies and the tool that he suggested that one have out on the water. Okay, Jason, let's see if they were paying attention.
All right.
Okay. And they're madly typing, I hope, on the other end. I haven't seen any answers yet come in here, so, okay. Wow. Okay. Here's the answer. Thermometer, ants, hoppers, and beetles. What do you think, Jason?
I'd probably go with, look up that thermometer right. The other three flies, got two of the three
right
missing. On that one.
Yeah, he's missing one of them, right?
Yeah, there's one that's, one's more of a midge pattern, really, than anything else.
Yeah, yeah, he got one of them wrong. Sorry, Dean, you got one of those flies wrong. Let's see if somebody... Okay, here's another one. Ants, beetles, Griffith's gnat, and fly suspension device. Nope, that's not what we're looking for. You got the flies right.
The flies. We're almost there.
Okay, here's one. Ants, Griffith's gnats, beetles, and a thermometer. I think we got a winner.
Hey, we have a winner. All right.
Doug Bannon.
But everybody's a winner. Don't worry about it. It's just a matter of degree.
Yeah, the other winners don't get your book, and
yes.
The one does. So Doug Bannis in Vancouver Island. Wow, nice place.
All right.
Doug, congratulations. You just won yourself a Borger book, Angler as Predator, which is an excellent book, one of the series. And I'm sure after you have that first one, you'll want to get the rest as well. I think, what do you have, about four now or five? Four?
It seems like 1,000, but I think it's four or five. Yeah, I'm on the five. I think I'm on the five right now. So hopefully five at the end of this year. And
yeah,
then,
yeah.
There's a few right there at the beginning that were hard to get done. But
yeah, now you guys are just rolling, huh? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. Doug, what you need to do is in that same text box, you can send me back your address so that we can get that mailed out to you, and we'll take care of that. So if you'll do that. Then, and or you could send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So either way, get me your address so that we can get that book out to you. Okay, well, Jason, hey, we really appreciate you being on the show again with us, and a pleasure, as always, to talk with you and explore a little part of the whole fishing picture. It's so big, so much to learn. But thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I guess a good night, or I guess depending where you are in the world, a good morning to all my fellow fly fishers out there.
That's right. We never know. We never know. Well, our next broadcast will be on October 16th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Jason Randall. And the topic for the show will be Moving Water, a Fly Fisher's Guide to Currents. Jason has done a thorough study of the effect of currents on trout, their prey species, and on our presentation. And if you listen in on this one, you're going to learn how to deal with these vertical layers of current that create drag and adjustments required to improve your nymph fishing success. So join us then on October 16th. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.